question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, August 30th, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
The U.S. officially exits Iraq. We'll find out the truth behind the withdrawal and what's behind the massive egg recall, plus a new weapon dubbed the Pain Ray, rejected by the military, is being embraced by the sheriff's office for use on inmates. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. In practical terms, nothing will change, quote unquote. That was the response of U.S. military spokesman General Stephen Lanza to the New York Times, commenting on the withdrawal of thousands of U.S. combat troops in Iraq. President Obama has touted the withdrawal as fulfilling his longtime promise to end the war in Iraq. However, 50,000 U.S. troops remain on 94 military bases in the country. Official word from the military is that the remaining troops are vested with the power to advise and train the nascent Iraqi army, provide security, and carry out counterterrorism operations. Echoing the words of General Lanza, a journalist for The Guardian called the so-called withdrawal a nothing more than a, quote, rebranding of the occupation. Heavy criticism is also being aimed at plans to increase the use of military contractors, even though this outsourced workforce has been highly controversial and expensive. The Iraqi government is considered by many to be practically non-functional, and results from the March elections are still under dispute. July was the deadliest month in 2 years, with 535 civilians killed, much more than in Afghanistan. August has seen near-constant bombings with a series of attacks throughout the country last Wednesday that killed at least 45 people in total and wounded many more. Iraqi military forces and police recruits have been specifically targeted in many of the bombings. Tomorrow, President Obama will address the nation in a speech that is anticipated to outline the administration's strategies in Iraq and Afghanistan. My guest is Hadani Ditmars. She's a journalist and writer who's traveled to Iraq many times between 1997 and 2003. She recently returned in March of this year. She's also the author of the best-selling 2006 book, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, A Woman's Journey Through Iraq, and also currently a co-editor at the New Internationalist magazine. Welcome to Uprising, Hadani.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So U.S. combat operations in Iraq are essentially being renamed stability operations. 50,000 U.S. troops will remain. So some troops have withdrawn, but 50,000 still remain. Is that enough to justify the use of the term withdrawal?
Well, it's all a bit of smoke and mirrors, isn't it? I mean, because, as you know, the U.S. military presence has not been kind of on the ground in the city's presence for a couple of years at least now. When we talk about withdrawal, it's not as if, you know, that the streets of Baghdad have, you know, just last week been full of American soldiers and now won't be. We're talking about them sort of withdrawing from outlying bases and areas. And, of course, there's still a huge U.S. presence in Iraq. An American embassy the size of Vatican City, several desert bases, et cetera, that are going to remain. But, I mean, I think we shouldn't really be focusing so much on the withdrawal. What we really have to look at are the larger systemic issues, the huge humanitarian catastrophe that Iraq is experiencing at the moment, where 7 years after the invasion, as you can read about in the May issue of New Internationalist, which I traveled back to Baghdad in February, March to write and photograph. 7 years later, the legacy of this invasion is that 43% of Iraqis live in abject poverty, 70% don't have access to clean drinking water, huge unemployment rate, terrible security situation, drastic decline in the status of women, and a secular society that has become Islamicized in a bad way. I mean, I don't even want to call it Islamicized. Just militia rule has become the norm. So I think we have to look at these larger underlying issues. I don't think that this so-called withdrawal is really going to affect those issues one way or another. It could have a short-term, as it has in the past several weeks, upswing in violent attacks, a further deterioration of the security situation. But the underlying issues and the underlying damage that has been done by this disastrous invasion and occupation are still there. It still need to be addressed.
Now, what is the so-called advisory role that the U.S. troops will play to the Iraqi army? What does that mean?
I don't work for the Pentagon, so I can't tell you exactly, but I assume that it's going to be a very hands-on approach rather than arm's length. At the same time, there is a sense of abandonment. I mean, I'm sure you read the Tariq Aziz interview in The Guardian a few weeks ago where he said that Iraq is not ready and that the Americans, by withdrawing, are abandoning Iraq to the wolves. Well, I would say that Iraq has already been abandoned to the wolves, sadly. So this could just make a bad situation worse. It's not really a full withdrawal. It's not really the end of the occupation. But in terms of an advisory role, perhaps there will still be some sort of military advice going on. It's really just kind of window dressing, as I say, for the larger issues. There's still a political power vacuum. There's still a huge issue around sectarian violence and sectarian strife. It's a bit frustrating when you've been covering Iraq for as long as I have, since 1997. That obviously, the media in the West is primarily interested in Iraq when there's some news that really is more about America than Iraq. You know, when there's been a bombing or even the elections, which were kind of pseudo democratic, I would say there was a flurry of media interest in Iraq. But it's very difficult to get people interested in the status of women and how it's declined drastically, or in the larger issue of how this once secular society has become radicalized and fundamentalist, etc. So, I think obviously the $53 billion that's been spent on quote-unquote aid, a lot of that has gone to military hardware in the name of military advisory activities. A lot of that has gone into the pockets of American military contractors. So, and of course, to this growing army of mercenaries.
And I want to ask you about that further privatizing of the occupation. But first, what do ordinary Iraqis, what is the view of most Iraqis? Obviously, it's not going to be homogeneous, but if you can give us a sense of what most Iraqis think about the security situation in their country, it would be helpful.
Well, I don't know if you read the issue that I wrote and photographed, but there is a fellow I met, Muwafaq Abtayi, who's a 68-year-old architect and former Saddam-era town planner. And he's quite an interesting fellow because as he was being forced to build these terrible villas for Saddam, he was also a communist and a Shia, so he was being spied upon at the same time. And then he was almost killed by U.S. troops when he was post-invasion, when he was doing a project with the Marsh Arabs. So he's rather philosophical, as are many Iraqis, and he says in the issue, that Iraqis, always sort of make do, and anarchy is the mother of invention, and we'll get through this. But there's this incredible sort of resilience that people have, which I just find staggering, really, because the average Iraqi has been through so much. At the time of elections, they were quite cynical about what was going on, and rightly so, because there was nothing really in the way of campaign finance laws. There were incumbents like Ahmed Chalabi who were simultaneously running for office and at the same time nixing the bids of rival opponents under the auspices of the infamous De-Bassification Commission. Government forces were rounding up opponents and jailing them under trumped-up terrorism charges. So, some Iraqis, a lot of Iraqis I met were not voting, and they were quite cynical about it. At the same time, when the polling stations were being bombed, this sort of encouraged Iraqis to actually get out and vote, almost in spite of what was going on. Lately, when I've been speaking with Mowafiq in Baghdad, he just says, well, we're just getting on with it. The country isn't really being run by the politicians. It's being run by the Iraqi people, and we're just trying our best to make do. It's almost like they've been set adrift. They have no real functioning state. And this is really a contrast from, of course, the Ba'athist years when the state was the great provider, when Iraq had the best public health and education system in the Arab world. Having said that, the state still remains the main employer. It's really sad to see what's happened to the country. Going back even for the first time in 7 years, I was shocked just to see how Baghdad had been so completely broken and colonized and walled off into sectarian neighborhoods. If you look at the fact spread in the May issue of New Internationalist, there's some quite damning statistics, but there's also a very telling map of Baghdad, one from 2003, from before the invasion, and one from 2008. And I don't know if you had a chance to look at that, but you'll see that in 2003, most of the neighborhoods were mixed, meaning Sunni, Shia, Christian, Muslim, Arab, Kurd. After the invasion in 2008, the majority of the, and particularly after the sectarian wars of 2006 and 2007, most of Baghdad neighborhoods were sectarian enclaves and the majority Shia. So the whole social fabric of, not to mention the political landscape, has shifted radically. Hmm. And Iraqis are really, I think, just left reeling from it all and trying to struggle for daily survival.
I'm speaking with Hadani Ditmars. She's a journalist and writer and the author of the best-selling 2006 book, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, A Woman's Journey Through Iraq. She's also the co-editor at the New Internationalist magazine, and she wrote and photographed the latest issue. And you can find out more at her website, hadanidittmars.com. We'll also link to it from our site where you can and from her site, you can buy autographed copies of her best-selling book, Dancing in the No-Fly Zone. Let's talk about the mercenaries, the military contractors, of which there are, I believe, 100,000 private contractors that are working for the remaining U.S. occupation forces. What exactly are these private contractors doing, and what does it mean for Iraqis that they're going to increase the number of private contractors, even as they've decreased the number of U.S. troops?
Well, I think your listeners are probably familiar with the infamous antics of Blackwater, etc. But this is, of course, not a new situation. There's been mercenaries on the ground since right after the invasion. And it's not a phenomenon that's unique to Iraq either. I understand the U.S. military does this kind of thing in other places as well, this sort of privatizing of the army. When I was there in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, there were a lot of Hondurans that I met who seemed to be literally dying to get their green cards, because this was sort of a way for them to, become a full-fledged U.S. citizen. And so there were a lot of foreign nationals doing that kind of security work, and then there were the other category of former SAS types who were doing more senior and better-paid sort of mercenary jobs. So there certainly has been a lot of contracting out. It's a tragic situation. I guess I'm less interested in foreign mercenaries than I am in the fate of the Iraqi people and in their culture and how it's been destroyed. So I don't know if you want to talk to me about that, but what can I say? More mercenaries, bad news. I think we're all familiar with their track record on human rights and assassinations, and you know, it can't be a good thing. It can't be a good thing.
Well, finally, let's talk about the results of the elections. There is still a lot of discussion about and disagreement about the results of the elections themselves. There was a sense that a civil war could come out of the strife and the elections. Tell our listeners what happened with the March elections, and I believe you were there in Iraq, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was. Well, as I said a few minutes ago, the elections, in fact, were in many ways a kind of a pseudo democracy, because, as I just explained, there were all kinds of violations of basic sort of election rules and ethics, not the least of which was that incumbents were allowed to campaign with state funds, and while they were running themselves, in the instance of, for example, Ahmed Chalabi, they were also disqualifying rivals under the debathification laws. So, and of course, I think, you know, your listeners were probably familiar, or perhaps not, with the fact that Maliki's troops were quite busy rounding up opponents and jailing them under trumped-up terrorism charges. That said, and the cynicism expressed by many people that I talked to from all walks of life and sectarian backgrounds, not just the Sunnis, the sort of disaffected Sunnis, but, you know, working-class Shias, all kinds of people said, I'm not voting. Because of the bombing of the polling stations, there was this kind of sense of I'm out of defiance and I'm going to go out and vote, you know, whatever the cost. So there was actually quite a high voter turnout. And there was a certain amount of enthusiasm for the elections as well, in terms of the numbers of people who were running as candidates, whether they had a chance of winning or not, was another question. But everyone from the former orchestra conductor of the Iraqi National Orchestra to a Sufi sheikh to a woman journalist that I used to know who had worked for CNN, they were all running for office. But, you know, really, now we're at this political impasse. Iraq remains the fifth most corrupt country in the world, according to Transparency International. So I feel that, you know, Iraqis are really losing faith in the political process. And as I said, their daily lives have now been reduced to this quite stark struggle for survival.
Well, Hadani Ditmars, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And we'll link to your website from our site later. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hadani Ditmars is a journalist and writer who is the author of the book Dancing in the No-Fly Zone, A Woman's Journey Through Iraq. We've been talking about the U.S. So-called withdrawal from Iraq and how Iraqis are coping with the state of their country right now. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, what's behind the massive egg recall? And later in the hour, we'll learn about a new so-called pain ray that the sheriff's office here in L.A. County has embraced. It was rejected by the U.S. military. Stay tuned.
Here is a special KPFK local station board election update. Ballots for the 2010 election are in the mail. And that means it's time for the KPFK local station board election on-air forums. Hello, everyone. My name is Sanchez, a volunteer producer here at KPFK. Join me and the local election supervisor every night this week from Monday, August 30th through Friday, September 3rd, from 8 until 9 p.m. as I host and moderate this year's 2010 election forums. Each night, we'll feature five candidates who want to represent you, the listener members, on the KPFK local station board. Who is best qualified to represent you for the next 3 years? What questions do you have for the candidates? We'll take your calls for the candidates live on the air. We'll also read your email questions for the candidates. It's the KPFK local station board on air forums from Monday, August 30th through Friday, September 3rd, every night from 8 to 9 p.m. here on KPFK.
Hi, I'm Arundhati Roy, and you're listening to Uprising with Sonali Kolhatkar.
Over the past 2 weeks, more than half a billion eggs have been recalled from across the United States due to incidents of salmonella poisoning. Nearly 1,500 cases of illness related to the recall have been reported, and at least one lawsuit against it has already been filed. The eggs originate from Wright County Egg Farm and Hillendale Farms in Iowa, and are sold under 13 different brand names, including Mountain Dairy, Ralph's, Albertson, Dutch Farms, and Farm Fresh. The Humane Society of the United States launched an ad campaign making it clear that all the eggs being recalled have been laid by hens crammed into cages. Salmonella poisoning has been linked to caged hens by various studies, including in a report earlier this year by World Poultry headlined "Salmonella Thrives in Cage Housing." Yet advocates of industrial agriculture routinely deny the connection. Lawmakers in New York have responded by promising to pass bills requiring that all egg-producing hens be vaccinated against salmonella. My guest is J.D. Hansen, a policy analyst at the Center for Food Safety. Welcome to Uprising, J.D.
Well, good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. How widespread is this contamination, and have these eggs essentially been distributed to all 50 states?
Well, probably not all 50, but certainly 25 or so.
Hmm.
These are mega cities filled with laying hens. We're talking about a couple of farms with about 5 million hens each.
So food inspection in the U.S., you would think, would find such cases for certain instances of improper facilities. You know, the whole issue of food safety in the United States is a very, very problematic topic. But ideally, we'd want federal government, federal agency inspectors going to farms across the country and periodically examining them. Why was that not done? Or was there some sort of failure here with respect to these two farms?
Well, it's not just those two farms. For the last 30 years, the Food and Drug Administration has been inspecting all facilities less and less. And, a facility like this, unfortunately, could expect to see an inspector only about every 4 years, which is absolutely crazy. This particular operator is a serial offender. Had problems in, wherever they've operated.
Are you talking about Wright County Egg Farm?
Wright County Egg Farm. Mm-hmm. When they've operated in Maine, they've had problems. When they operated in Maryland, they've had problems.
What sort of problems?
Well, they've had salmonella problems before. They have been on the facilities in Iowa. They were cited during the Clinton administration for egregious worker safety violations, including not giving workers basic equipment like gloves. So they were picking up dead chickens and handling chicken manure with their bare hands and then contaminating the chickens.
Now, how does salmonella poisoning occur? I said the Humane Society is making the connection, and others have as well, between caged hens and salmonella poisoning. And I was looking at one article this morning which had the very last line of the article just sort of throw out, quote, "Rodents in food packaging and distribution facilities are the most common source of salmonella contamination." What exactly causes salmonella?
Well, salmonella is a it's a bacteria. It's not uncommon in sick animals, but it's a carried by mammals primarily, but also by birds. Pigeons would be another source. And if you've got a facility that's not cleaned out well, you're going to have mice and rats attracted to the manure, if nothing else. And then when you stack cages on top of cages, you've got sick chickens whose droppings fall on other chickens, and they get sick, and in this case, they were even feeding the hens contaminated feed. So it seems that one of the main sources in this case actually was contaminated feed, and then the chickens get that in their body. They pass it down into the eggs, and we eat the eggs and get sick ourselves.
What sort of contamination in the feed are we talking about? I mean, essentially, is this, again, chicken feces?
Well, it could be anything from, ground-up animal products are one of the things that are in some of the feeds. The other thing is, if the feed is not handled properly, you'll get mice and rats and birds defecating in it. So you have a contaminated feed source that you then feed the animals.
Now, the Humane Society of the U.S. released a graph showing that cage-free eggs have about half the odds of salmonella contamination compared to battery cage eggs. And then they have another category, free-range eggs, that have only a tiny fraction of the incidence of salmonella compared to even cage-free eggs. I didn't even realize there was a difference between cage-free and free-range eggs. Can you explain?
Well, you can have a cage-free chicken that's still rather confined in a chicken house. You know, the cage chickens, many of them don't even have enough room to even stretch their wings. Their only job is to eat and produce eggs. And a chicken that in years past only produced a dozen or two dozen eggs a year are now producing 150 eggs a year. That's all they're doing. You can get a better life for the chickens by not caging them. But if you still keep them pretty confined, they are going to pass on whatever illness they have to other chickens just because they're so crowded.
So cage-free hens are still confined, just not in cages, but in a slightly bigger space. And then free-range hens are ones that are allowed to actually essentially move around in a large open space?
They move around in a large open space, or sometimes they still have a movable fence, so that they just move it from one part of the pasture to the other.
And so the incidence of salmonella between caged hens and free-range hens that produce eggs is dramatic. It's just a tiny fraction that free-range eggs, tiny fraction of the incidence that free-range eggs have. From the consumer point of view, the best kind of eggs to then look for are the free-range ones, right?
Well, those are the ones I eat myself.
What about organic? Where does the label organic fit into all of this?
One of the things that organic does is it really changes what can go into the poultry feed. Most of your listeners, would be surprised that ordinary chicken feed does have ground up animals in it. Does have genetically modified organisms in it, antibiotics, pesticides.
And what the chicken eats goes into its eggs, essentially, right?
That's right. And so, but organic feed, you can't have animals in it, you can't have GMOs in it, you can't have antibiotics in it, you can't have pesticides in it, you can't have grains with chemical fertilizer. So you start out with an organic chicken not having things that are likely to contaminate its eggs.
So does the label organic then have any bearing on whether a hen is cage-free or free-range?
No, you could have a caged...
You could have battery hens that are fed organic feed and then the eggs are labeled organic.
You could, yes.
So from all of these various categories of eggs, which one is the best?
Well, I think it's a mixing a couple things. The California voters in 2008 supported an initiative that the Center for Food Safety and the Humane Society sponsored, saying that chickens that people in California eat and eggs from those chickens, I believe it's by 2015, won't be, they won't be allowed to sell any chickens or eggs in California that didn't come from cage-free chickens. So cage-free would be the first thing I would do. Ideally, an organic hen that is on a open pasture would be the best.
So free-range organic would be the ideal. My guest is J.D. Hansen. He's the policy analyst at the Center for Food Safety. We're talking about the massive egg recall. Now, let's talk about California. Many consumers are turning to California farmers to buy eggs in the wake of this recall because apparently there hasn't been any cases of salmonella contamination from California eggs in over a decade. What is California currently doing right?
Well, I think you've got a more aggressive effort to keep chicken operations clean. I mean, some of it is, if you go to the cheapest chicken producer, which, some of your California grocery markets are doing, you've got these contaminated eggs at least nationally, have been bought by some of your California chains. Safeway, Albertsons, Ralph's are among the ones that have bought these contaminated eggs. I don't believe you've got them there in Southern California, but a couple of parts of California have had them.
So that means that, so what you're saying is that Californians who bought their eggs at Ralph's and Albertsons might still be eating contaminated eggs from Iowa, but what about eggs that are produced in California currently? Why has there not been a salmonella outbreak in California farms in over a decade?
Well, the two basic things, in addition to what we've already talked about in terms of organic, cage-free, but if you're a big producer, you can greatly reduce the incidence of salmonella by having a clean operation, and even more so by vaccinating your chickens.
And that's an important question. Let me ask you about this whole vaccination issue, because it's one thing to talk about making the hens cage free to try to reduce salmonella poisoning, but then where does salmonella vaccination come into all of this? If the end result of this egg recall, if the only thing that's actually done about this egg recall is to vaccinate the hens, will that solve the problem?
Well, I think it really needs to have a combination of things. When I go overseas to Africa, I take a vaccine against typhoid, which is a kind of salmonella. It doesn't mean I go out and drink the dirtiest water I can. So the chickens still need to be treated well. They still need to have a clean environment. You don't want them getting sick all the time. But in the United Kingdom, the grocers there, instead of buying salmonella eggs, told producers they won't buy your eggs if you've got a record of producing salmonella in your eggs. So what's happened in the last 15 years in the United Kingdom, through a combination of cleaner operations and vaccination, they have reduced their salmonella incidence by over 90%.
Now, is it safe to eat eggs produced by vaccinated hens?
Well, I know there's a lot of debate about vaccines, I think the main thing is, are the vaccines safe for the hens? I mean, you don't want to eat vaccinated hens or eat their eggs if the rest of the process that they're using to produce the hens is contaminated too. So I would say you've demonstrated in a number of the California growers that you can produce hens without vaccination that are salmonella free, mostly by having a clean operation.
Now, caged eggs are obviously linked to the salmonella poisoning, but how does our centralized food system also contribute to the extent of the outbreaks? If there's only two farms in Iowa that are producing, 500 million eggs that are sold under 13 names to the, major parts of the United States, that essentially can take any kind of an outbreak and spread it far and wide. But if you had localized food production and consumption, you could limit such outbreaks to small population an area. How much does a centralized industrial food system play a role in the extent of this outbreak?
Well, I think, you know, we've seen a centralized food system causing problems in a number of ways, whether it's tomatoes or bell peppers or jalapeno peppers or leafy greens or eggs. If you produce it only in a few places, and worse than that, if you package it improperly in just a few places, there's a problem. I mean, in this case, the chickens themselves had the salmonella right in the egg from the very beginning. If you had a packaging operation that wasn't doing a good job and was breaking eggs that were contaminated and contaminating the shells of others, then you could spread this very quickly to even clean eggs.
Mm. Finally, J.D., what do you think is going to happen in the wake of this egg recall? What are the steps being taken aside from sending USDA inspectors to these two Iowa farms? Could the rest of the country take the lead from California in terms of food safety, particularly where eggs are concerned? And is there any movement to do that?
Well, there is. In fact, Michigan, another big egg producer, same year that California voted that they would go cage-free, Michigan voted to go cage-free, and their efforts in a number of other states to have egg producers go cage-free. So that's a step in the right direction. The other thing that's happened is in the last 30 years, there's been an explosion of farmers markets. Most farmers markets have a number of folks selling very good eggs, locally produced, that aren't going to get you sick. Or if they do, at least you know who got you sick. You go back the next week. So I would, urge your listeners to go visit the farmers markets. You can get some really good eggs and even different breeds than you can get from the mega producers.
Where can people find out more about your organization, the Center for Food Safety?
If you'd go to our website, thecenterforfoodsafety.org, you could find out about a lot of the different programs we're working on.
That's centerforfoodsafety.org?
Yes.
I want to thank you very much for joining us today, J.D. Hansen.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
J.D. Hansen is the policy analyst at the Center for Food Safety. Again, their website, centerforfoodsafety.org. And we'll link to that from our website, uprisingradio.org. And by the way, all of our interviews are archived on our website. So if you wanted to go back and listen to this interview again to get the information about what are the best kind of eggs to buy, just check out uprisingradio.org. Also, Uprising is about to launch an outreach campaign to get the word out about this program and KPFK. There are still far too many people in Southern California who've never tuned in. Now, KPFK is listener-sponsored, so we don't have the big budget of a Clear Channel station to buy billboard ads, but we do have dedicated listeners like you. If you'd like to volunteer just a few hours to be part of our outreach team, please email us at mail@uprisingradio.org or call Jesse at 818-985-2711, extension 513. This is Uprising. Back in just a moment.
If you don't give a heck about the man with the Bible in his hand.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. An experimental crowd control weapon originally designed for military use in Afghanistan and Iraq is now slated for domestic use. The weapon is known by various names, including the Assault Intervention Device, the Active Denial System, the Silent Guardian, and unofficially, the Pain Ray. The device uses concentrated beams of electromagnetic radiation to produce pain and burning sensations in its targets. Although the device is non-lethal officially and does not produce permanent injury, a miscalibration of power settings during Air Force testing caused five airmen to suffer lasting burns, including one whose injuries were severe enough to warrant an airlift to an off-base burn treatment center. The system was deployed to Afghanistan briefly this summer, but was removed from service without being used operationally. The defense contractor Raytheon Missile Systems has developed a scaled-down version of the heat ray device specifically for L.A. County's Sheriff's Department, which plans to install it in the Los Angeles County jails before Labor Day. Working with the Department of Justice, the L.A. Sheriff's Department will have a six-month trial of the device at Pitches Detention Center in Castaic, California, before deciding to install it in other jails. The American Civil Liberties Union and the ACLU of Southern California are concerned that the device could cause permanent injury and that its use is, quote, tantamount to torture. They sent a letter criticizing the decision to Sheriff Lee Baca last Thursday. The ACLU has extensively documented L.A. County Jail's history of overcrowding, deputy violence, retaliation, and abuse against inmates and prisoner-on-prisoner assaults. It is the largest and most expensive jail system in the nation. More than half of those housed have yet to be convicted and are awaiting trial. My guest is Margaret Winter, Associate Director of the National ACLU Prison Project in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Uprising, Margaret.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, I wanted to quote Peter Eliasberg from the ACLU of Southern California. He's with the Jails Project. He says that this is a weapon that can cause serious injury that is being put into a place where there is a long history of abuse of prisoners. That's a toxic combination. First, let's talk about the weapon itself before we talk about its use in Southern California jails. What does it mean that the that a scaled-down version of the heat ray device has been made for the sheriff's department? Is this a slightly less painful pain ray?
No, I don't think there's any evidence that it's less painful. It's usable in a, it's portable, basically. It's a 7.5 foot tall robotic machine.
So it's scaled down only in size?
It's portable. It's scaled down only in size. And I report by a noted physicist in 2008, Dr. Jürgen Altman analyzed the extreme damage that this machine is capable of inflicting. When they demonstrated, it all looks very nice because an individual volunteer who had demonstrated on will simply move out of the path of the microwave beam, which literally microwaves the skin. The trouble is that it's completely dependent, as Dr. Altman points out in his report, on there not being any abuse on the part of the operator of the machine. If it is re-triggered on the same target, or if the blast of the beam goes on for more than a couple of seconds, then you're looking at inflicting second and third degree burns.
So in a way, it's like a taser, something that's supposed to not be lethal, but if misused, if the person who's holding the taser decides to use it as a torture device, they can do so.
Exactly. There are also problems, you know, just technological problems with miscalibrating it, which is how the two airmen got seriously injured during the testing of it. So it's perfectly capable of being used as a lethal weapon in the hands of somebody who wishes to abuse it. And we've seen with tasers how many tragic deaths have resulted from misuse of the taser.
So this particular weapon, which was initially slated to be used in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan by the military, produced by Raytheon Missile Systems, essentially cooks you? I mean, it's a microwave?
Yeah, it's a microwave beam, Sonali. And
I couldn't think of any other way to say it. I mean,
yeah. And kind of the horror of this is that we're talking here about a deliberate infliction of pain and way excessive use of force to control prisoners when the means of controlling prisoners and maintaining security in a prison are well known and don't require this kind of overkill, if I may use that phrase. Mm-hmm. It seems to us that this is this kind of use. It's just laying open the situation for predictable violations of the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and the Due Process Clause. We're talking here about the unnecessary infliction of pain and the excessive use of force to attain what could be attained by other means.
And
so it's a very, very scary situation here.
And I'm assuming that there hasn't been enough testing done on this to find out about long-term effects. I mean, what about causing things like cancer by using such kinds of devices?
That I don't know, but I do know that we don't even have to look at the long-term effects to know that it's a scary thing, because the short-term effects are immediate and potentially catastrophic. And the situation seems to be that the U.S. government is interested in using prisoners as guinea pigs to test this out domestically as part of the whole Homeland Security operation. You know, as a method of crowd control, as a method of controlling First Amendment activity of demonstrations and protests, and being able to disperse crowds with this portable robotic microwave device. Mm. So I think that although we're seeing it first here in this country being applied against prisoners and pretrial detainees, many of whom have never even been convicted of anything. But what it's destined to, based on the words coming out of the Department of Justice, the Bureau of Justice, is that its ultimate destination is not just for prisoners; it's for use in civilian crowd control.
So let's talk about what the plans are then in Castaic to try this particular device out for 6 months at Pitches Detention Center. Is it that they're going to ask inmates to volunteer themselves to test it out on them, or are they just going to have it on hand in case there is some kind of fight or some kind of violence breaks out?
Well, I doubt that they're going to be asking for volunteers among the inmates, but we don't know yet what the exact plans are. What it sounds like from everything that Sheriff Baca has said is that this thing is going to be available and they're going to use it when they want to use it.
And it's amazing how the announcement was just made. I mean, this just became public and they're already going to put it into use, into this trial use at least, in just a few days before Labor Day.
Well, it seems like this must be coordinated with the U.S. government. This clearly isn't just a move by Sheriff Baca on his own. This is a big step that has implications nationally, and I think it was probably carefully coordinated how and where this device would be rolled out.
I'm speaking with Margaret Winter, Associate Director of the National ACLU Prison Project. She's joining us live from Washington, D.C. Now, the U.S. military rejected the use of this device in Afghanistan and Iraq. Why?
Not entirely clear, but there was a statement by the Secretary of the Air Force a couple of years ago that they were, he was afraid of that he was going to be vilified in the international press if this thing was used extensively in foreign contexts without the United States having deployed it on its own citizens extensively. So it's interesting that he was bearing vilification in the international press, and so the next step is let's use it domestically and see what happens. Then there was the incident with the U.S. airmen getting seriously injured in the testing of it.
So bad PR, basically.
Yeah.
Now, it's the fact that it's being used on inmates essentially speaks to how little attention is paid to the inside of California's jails. Would you agree?
I think that it's not just California's jails. Jails and prisons, this vast, vast network where 2.2 million men, women, and children in the United States are being detained in prisons, jails, and detention centers are pretty dark places. And, by their very nature, the prison and jail officials don't usually want transparency. Terrible things go on that people don't see, and it's the a responsibility of the ACLU and of all people who understand that the conditions of our prisons and how prisoners are treated is a human rights issue that should be of interest to everybody. It's up to all of us to try to pierce that darkness and open some windows and let some light come in and find out what's really going on. It affects all of us. And we really all could get burned by this pain ray machine.
No pun intended, huh?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Peter Elias's comment about it being a toxic combination to put this so-called pain ray into a place where there is a long history of abuse, at least here in Southern California, inside the jail systems. The ACLU of Southern California has extensively documented the LA County Jail's history of violence and retaliation and abuse against inmates and overcrowding. What are the possible scary scenarios under which such a weapon could be deployed, and how concerned should we be?
We need to be very concerned because in the intensive monitoring that the ACLU has been doing in LA County Jail, we've seen, a very, very disturbing pattern of deputy abuse of inmates, and particularly mentally ill inmates. And we've seen extreme incidents of retaliation, a real pattern against any prisoners who complain about conditions or deputy abuse. And this has been documented in an extensive report that the ACLU puts out annually. Most recently, I think it was in April of 2010, and we're about to shortly be releasing a supplement on new information of violence and abuse that's come out even in the last few months. So it's very scary. It is a very toxic combination to have this kind of lack of control over kind of a culture of a subculture of violence and abuse, and then putting weapons like this into the hands of a force of deputies that won't necessarily be able to deal properly with such a weapon.
Now, you talked earlier about the possibility of this weapon eventually being used against protesters and demonstrations and infringing people's First Amendment rights, and that the inmates here in California and other jails are essentially guinea pigs. Is there, for this pain ray, is there any evidence that you've seen that that confirms that this is the first step in deploying this against the, against the people here domestically in a crowd control situation on the streets?
Yeah, I think there's lots of evidence of that. The Department of Justice has been touting a civilian application of this weapon in its, you can look on U.S. government websites and find it as a method of domestic crowd control, both in the prison context and in the law enforcement context. So I don't think that it's really a secret. I think that there's very broad hints, to say the least, that that's where we are headed.
So what can people do?
I think people should be real alert to looking up and watching the news on this, and that they should be protesting it in every possible way. They should be writing letters to the editors. They should be blogging about it. They should be conscious about it. They should make sure others know about it. We shouldn't wait around and accept the militarization of our, of our civil society. And take it for granted that more and more we're going to be treated as if there is a, we're in a war scenario here at home.
Now, what about bringing it up to our members of Congress? And do you know if any member of Congress has tried to take any action on it, maybe to hold hearings on this? I mean, this could be something that, and ought to be something that Congress should take up.
I think it should be something that Congress takes up. And I think that we need a lot more investigation about the studies that have been done on this, the intended applications, the cost. There's some information out there, but it's obviously the cost of this is enormous.
It almost seems as though, you know, the U.S. military had paid Raytheon to develop this, using taxpayers' dollars to develop this weapon. And since it couldn't be used in Iraq and Afghanistan because of the bad PR, they needed some use for the work that they put into this Pain Ray. And so now it's being used on our inmates and potentially in the future against demonstrators and Americans who are outside the jails as well. Margaret, where can listeners find out more through the ACLU? What's the best website?
I think if you go to www.aclu.org/prisonersrights, you will find the information.
Prisoners' rights?
Yeah.
aclu.org/prisonersrights. Margaret Winter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Margaret Winter is the Associate Director of the National ACLU Prison Project, joining us from Washington, D.C. We've been talking about the new weapon that is being launched here in Southern in California, in Castaic, California, at Pitches Detention Center. Before Labor Day, it's going to start, Sheriff Lee Baca is going to start a six-month trial there. You can find out more at aclu.org/prisonersrights. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Isaac Asimov once said, "Violence is the last refuge of the incompetent." That's Isaac Asimov. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our interim assistant producer. Laurel Berger is our intern. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Our website is uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Golhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.